We now have much pleasure in inviting Brother Roger Lewis to lead us in his study this evening, The Destruction of Benjamin and the Folly of Vengeance.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. So here we are gathered in after a fresh evening shower to ready ourselves again now for a consideration of Phineas. And you'll remember that in our last study, we left him, did we not, on that occasion in Joshua 22, where he had enough grace and enough goodness to admit that he had gone too far. He had the courage to say that he had perhaps been mistaken, and he quickly moved to that splendid spirit whereby all of the controversy between the tribes was reconciled, and he brought back an answer that, remember, it says, pleased the congregation. And that same spirit of pleasure was to be found, was it not, in the Jerusalem conference many years later. Those who desire to achieve reconciliation genuinely, of course, always do find pleasure when it occurs, if that is truly their spirit and their desire. And you'll remember that when we looked at Joshua 22 this morning, we said that we believed that this was a man of about 60 years of age, that this is about 10 years into the record of Joshua. Well, this evening then, we're going to move forward some considerable period of time, because we're going to come right through the end of the book of Joshua and into the book of Judges itself. But at the very start, really, of the book of Judges, despite the fact, of course, that we've read this evening from Judges chapter 20. Actually, just before we do that, I thought I might just remember to do a piece of homework that I've forgotten so far, and that's the question of why is Phineas called the mouth of brass? Do you remember that? We asked that question earlier on. If you come to Isaiah 48 for a moment, into the fourth verse, just a thought with regard then to the meaning of his name. And perhaps this is appropriate in the context of both our study this morning and also the words that we're going to see in Judges this evening. In the prophecy of Isaiah and chapter 48 and verse 4 it says, "Because I knew that thou art obstinate, and thy neck is an iron sinew, and thy brow is brass." So here in Isaiah 48 verse 4 we have a brow of brass, which of course is not literal, it's symbolic. And what does the brow of brass symbolize? It symbolizes stubbornness of mind, a mind that will not change. It comes from the idea of the hardness of the metal, does it not? Not that it represents a mind of flesh particularly, but a mind that is stubborn or hard, as the margin says, for the word obstinate. Now, if you come to Job chapter 40, we're told there, in some interesting words concerning the massive size of Behemoth, we're told this in Job 40 and verse 18. It says there, describing this great creature, "His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief of the ways of God." And obviously the bones of brass of Behemoth in Job 40 verse 18 are not particularly that he was necessarily a creature of flesh, but that the brass here is a symbol of hardness. He is an immensely powerful animal with an amazingly strong constitution. And again, it's from the idea of the hardness of the metal. Now come to Jeremiah chapter 15. Actually, the same words are mentioned in Jeremiah 1, but we'll look at them in Jeremiah 15. And you see what it says there at the end of the chapter concerning the mission of the prophet. In Jeremiah 15 and verse 19. And there the record says, "Therefore thus saith Yahweh, if thou return, then will I bring thee again, and thou shalt stand before me, and if thou take forth the precious from the vial, thou shalt be as my mouth. Let them return unto thee, but return not thou unto them, and I will make thee unto this people a fenced brazen wall, And they shall fight against thee, but they shall not prevail against thee, for I am with thee to save thee. So you see, here was a prophet who was at once to be both the mouthpiece of God and a brazen wall. What's the sense of the brazen wall here? Not that it is the thinking or the expression of the flesh, but that it was a wall of such immense power that they would not be able to prevail against it. So if a brow of brass represents a stubborn mind, and bones of brass represent the hardness of the constitution of Behemoth, then what does a mouth of brass represent? And I think that it symbolizes here, you see, forthrightness of speech, strong, blunt, unyielding speech. He would be a man who would be a spokesman for divine principles, and they might fight against him, but they would not prevail. He would be a forthright spokesman for those things that he considered to be right. He would be a champion for holiness and the great enemy of corruption. And he would speak fearlessly on those things. All his life would this man, the man who's described as the mouth of brass. And at times, of course, that mouth led him into trouble, didn't it? As we saw in our study this morning, how that because he was so passionate about the dangers of corruption within the ecclesia, which he did view with concern, and rightly so, but he got so worked up about it that he went a little too far, a little too fast, didn't he, with that same mouth of brass. And he spake that which he ought not to have said. Well, we're going to come across some further words from the mouth of this man in Judges this evening. Now, just a brief explanation then, as we make the transition from the book of Joshua to the book of Judges. Just come to Numbers 27 for a moment, because you'll remember that in the days of Moses, that Moses was the undeniable leader of the congregation. It was always Moses and Aaron, wasn't it? Aaron may have been the priest, but Moses was undoubtedly the leader. But when Moses died, the situation, says the divine record, changed. Because in Numbers 27, we're told that despite the fact that Joshua was to be appointed as the successor of Moses, it says this in verse 20 of Numbers 27. Perhaps verse 18 for connection. It says, Yahweh said unto Moses, Take thee Joshua the son of Nun, the man in whom is the Spirit, and lay thine hand upon him, and set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation, and give him a charge in their sight, and thou shalt put some of thine honour upon him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. And then notice these words, And he shall stand before the priest, the priest Eleazar, who shall ask counsel for him after the judgment of Urim before Yahweh, at his word. In other words, that's the word of the priest, which in turn, of course, is the word of God. At his word shall they go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the children of Israel with him, even all the congregation. So you see, although Joshua was appointed as the civil leader, who was the real leader from this time forth? And the answer was the high priest, Eleazar, before whom Joshua the son of Nun submitted. I know they had different roles, but there is a sense of order here. Now, just see how that works out. In Joshua chapter 14, for example, once that appointment had been made, now you see what it says in Joshua 14 verse 1, for example. What we're doing is we're picking up the idea here of leadership in the book of Joshua as we make the transition to the book of Judges. Where was leadership to be seen? Joshua 14 verse 1 says, And these are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, and Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed for inheritance to them. Eleazar and Joshua. And in that order, you notice, Joshua chapter 17 says, in the fourth verse, in the matter of the inheritance of the daughters of Zelophehad, we're told in Joshua 17 and verse 4, they came near before Eleazar the priest, and before Joshua the son of Nun, and before the princes, saying, and so on through Joshua chapter 19, Joshua chapter 21, we have Eleazar assuming that prominence of position throughout the record of the book of Joshua. So when we come to the end of the book of Joshua, as the book of Judges is about to open the record, therefore, whom might we expect to see elevated to that same position of leadership? And the answer is, of course, the next high priest, the high priest elect. That if Eleazar has had this position of responsibility and importance in the book of Joshua, then we would expect Phinehas, his son, to rise to a similar level of prominence in the next generation to come. And sure enough, when we come to Joshua 22, which we looked at this morning, as Eleazar begins to grow old, the mantle of responsibility you can see already passing, can't you, to Phinehas. Before the book of Joshua is finished, Phinehas has already been sent as the leader of the delegation. And so it would not be surprising, therefore, as we come to the book of Judges, that we come to at least the opening of that book and we find that Phinehas, in fact, is prominent in the record, as we shall see he indeed is. Now, I'd like you to take up the overheads for a moment, and we're just going to look at the first two overheads about the setting of the book of Judges, because this is really quite useful stuff just before we get into our study proper this evening, which is really based on Judges chapters 20 and 21. Now, you notice this. Just looking at the top part of 4b, which is described as the three appendices to the book of Judges. I know that we often say that the last few chapters of Joshua are the appendices, and I think rightly so. All I've done here is suggest that perhaps the book of Ruth should also be counted as an appendix to the book of Judges. Certainly the ancient manuscripts, the ancient Hebrew manuscripts, certainly counted or reckoned Ruth as being belonging to the book of Judges. In fact, the ancient method of numbering the books of the Old Testament that the Hebrews had was to count the book of Judges and the book of Ruth as effectively one book. So what we're saying is that there are some appendices here, you see. And when we look at the appendices, there is a principal person that appears in each of them. So you see on that overhead there, it says Appendix 1 is Judges 17 to 18. The principal character is Jonathan, who is the grandson of Moses. And the main theme of that appendix is corruption of principle. In the next section, or the next appendix, which is Judges 19 to 21, the principal character now is Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron. And the main theme of this appendix shall be corruption of practice that was to be found in the tribe of Benjamin. And when we come to the book of Ruth, we're going to find that the principal character is a man called Boaz, who is the grandson of Nahshon, and the main theme of this appendix is faithfulness of spirit in Judah. So you see, there were three tribes that would play a role in the story of these appendices. One common theme, by the way, to all three appendices, one place that appears in all three appendices in which this drama of the appendixes is played out. And that, of course, is the city of Bethlehem, Judah, which appears in all three of these appendices to the book of Judges. Now, you see who the three principal characters are. Go to the top of that chart and just have a look then at the genealogy. So at the top we have Amram and Aminadab, and below that we have Moses and Aaron, who were, of course, of Levi. And we have Nahshon, who's the son of Aminadab. He comes from the line of Judah, from the tribe of Judah. In fact, he's the prince of the tribe of Judah, and he's the same age as Moses, you see. So you see the three characters that we've got here. We've got Moses, whose son is Gershom, whose son is Jonathan. And we've got Phinehas, who is the grandson of Aaron, and we've got Boaz, who is the grandson of Nahshon. And so the three principal characters of the appendices to the book of Judges all spring from not only the same generation, but from the first generation of the book of Judges. You know why? Because you see Eleazar in the middle of that genealogy there. Eleazar dies. Well, does anybody know when Eleazar dies? Or where he dies in the divine record? Where does Eleazar die? In the last chapter of the book of Joshua. As the book of Joshua comes to a close, Joshua himself dies, Eleazar, his contemporary, dies. And so Phinehas and Jonathan and Boaz all spring from the very first generation of the book of Judges. Not only are they all from the same generation, but of course they're all related, aren't they? Because Phinehas and Jonathan were related as cousins, and Phinehas was related to Boaz because his grandmother, Elisheba, was a daughter of the prince, or a daughter of the tribe of Judah, and so Boaz was related to Phinehas as well. These three principal characters in the appendices to the Judges are all related together. Now come and have a look at the first overhead, which is entitled The Setting of the Appendices to the Judges, marked 4A. So we've already looked at the first couple of things. Now let's just make a note about these other matters. It says in both sections. Now what do we mean by both sections? Well, we're talking about the very earliest part of the book of Judges, chapter 1 verse 1 to chapter 2 verse 10, and then the last five chapters, 17 to 21, and the book of Ruth. In both sections, there is a marked absence in the record of any particular judge's leader. Nothing in the first two chapters, nothing in the last five. And the obvious implication is that the setting of these chapters, therefore, is before the first judge arises, whose name, of course, was Othniel. So the implication is that Judges 17 to 21 is part of that history of the judges that happens before Othniel arises. Next point is, in both sections there's reference to the primacy of Judah and to the weakness of Dan. In both sections there is the same reliance on priestly ministration to seek divine counsel through Urim and Thummim, and in both sections there is similar language concerning tribal dispersion after assembly. So what's all that about then? And the answer is that all we're saying is this: that the last five chapters of Judges, although they are at the end of the book, belong right at the start of the book in terms of chronology. They are actually the first things that happened. They're there at the end of the book because they've been placed there to act deliberately as a summary of the book as a whole. But in terms of the chronology of the book of Judges, these incidents in the last few chapters come right to the front of the story. And Phinehas is going to be there in this very early part of the book of Judges. So let's come to our four questions then, shall we? In 4C, which is the next overhead before we get underway. It says there, the first question is, why is Phinehas involved in such stern judgment against immorality in Benjamin, which is Appendix 2, and yet he offers no protest against the graver crime of idolatry in Dan, which is all to do with Appendix 1? So there's a good question for you. In fact, I'm going to say something more about that question in a moment. The second question is, why did God answer Phinehas' pleas by Urim and Thummim in the affirmative and then allow Israel to suffer defeat twice before Benjamin? Why did that happen? Why are we expressly told in Judges 20 verses 27 to 28 that Phinehas stood before the ark which was in Bethel in those days to seek counsel in those days? Why are we told that? And the last question, which perhaps is the most interesting of all in terms of our study this evening, is, was Phinehas a party to the vengeance upon Benjamin and that brutality and hypocrisy that subsequently occurred in Jabesh-Gilead and in Shiloh? Was Phinehas part of that story or not? Well, let us see as we proceed. Just a comment then about the first appendix, the matter of corruption. You see why these appendices are obviously in a very significant order, aren't they? Because you see, these were the very things that Phinehas had learned in his own life. The lesson was that corruption of principle, which is the first appendix to the Judges, leads to corruption of practice, which is the second appendix to the Judges. Corruption of principle inevitably leads to corruption of practice. And let me just show you how serious and how tragic that corruption was. Because if you come to Judges chapter 18 and verse 30, at the end of the first appendix, In Judges chapter 18 and verse 30, it says, "And the children of Dan set up the graven image, and Jonathan the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land, and they set them up Micah's graven image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh." And most of you will probably know, of course, that when it says he was Jonathan the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he wasn't, was he? He wasn't the grandson of Manasseh. He was the grandson of Moses. And the Jews changed the writing of Judges 18 and verse 30. And you can actually see this if you ever look at any Hebrew scroll. It's written this way in every Hebrew manuscript. What they did is they added what's known as a supralinear N. You see, Moses is spelt M-S-H in the manuscript. But you see, because he is the son, the grandson rather, of Moses, it was deemed to be such a disgrace to the honor of their greatest leader that his grandson should be involved in apostasy, that they added the letter N over above so that it now reads M-N-S-H, and the Jews from that day forward read Manasseh instead of Moshe. But he wasn't the grandson of Manasseh, he was the grandson of Moses. And you can see that if you ever look at any Hebrew manuscript, you'll see that little N written in over the top to tell the Jews that are reading the manuscript that they ought not to read Moses. But he was the grandson of Moses. And he was the leader of an apostate religion, and he's the cousin of Phinehas. Can you imagine how Phinehas would have felt about that? You want to know how grave that apostasy was? We're told that it was set up in the tribe of Dan and the city of Dan, actually, verse 29, which, of course, was to the north, where they had taken a further inheritance, and this rival system of priesthood and religion was set up. Come to the 1st of Kings, chapter 12, just for a moment into the times of a man later on, in the days of the kings. In the 1st of Kings, chapter 12, and you'll probably remember this, a man called Jeroboam decided that he did not want the people traveling down to Jerusalem to keep the feasts. And so he decided to establish some alternative places of worship. And this is what he did, verse 28. It says in the 1st of Kings 12, "The king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Bethel, and the other put he in Dan." And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. "And he made an house of high places, and made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. And he ordained a feast in the 8th month, on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that's in Judah, and he offered upon the altar. So did he in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he'd made, and he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he'd made." Did you notice, brothers and sisters, in this setting up of a rival religion by Jeroboam, that it never says that he placed any priests in Dan? Did you notice that? Just in Bethel. But he set up the two golden calves in Dan and Bethel. But there's no mention of any priests in Dan. Why would that be? And I think the answer is that the remnants of the apostasy of Jonathan were still there. There was no need to set up a priesthood, an apostate priesthood in Dan. That had been set up a long time before. The remnants of that were still there from the time of Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, in the days of Judges, where corruption of principle had led to such disastrous consequences. So come back to the book of Judges then, and now let us look at the second appendix, which is the one that we really have before us this evening, which is the logical extension of the first. You see that the first deals with corruption of principle, and the second deals with corruption of practice. Now, I'm not going to take you through Judges 19, because I think this is another one of those episodes where we actually don't want to look at the subject in particular detail. It's the story of the concubine. you'll know the record. A man and his concubine stayed overnight at a place called Gibeah. An outrage occurred because of the wicked men of that city. The woman lost her life. And when the Levite that was there at that time, when he saw that the woman had lost her life, he actually cut her into 12 pieces and he mailed an envelope to all 12 tribes, including Benjamin, of course. And chapter 20, verse 1 says, and here was the result of this outrage that had occurred. It says, all the children of Israel went out and the congregation was gathered together as one man. They were absolutely united in terms of this particular problem. Verse 8, all the people arose as one man. Verse 11, all the men of Israel were gathered together against the city, knit together as one man. You know, one of the marvelous things in the divine record, brothers and sisters, is the amazing unity that always occurred in Israel whenever they were dealing with a matter of sin amongst the brethren. And they were knit together on this occasion that they might deal with this matter. And they came up and they held a council, you see, as to what they might do. And they decided that they needed to deal with the matter, of course, and to bring judgment, therefore, upon Gibeah, and ultimately upon Benjamin, because they would not hearken to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. And so we know the story, and now we're going to pick it up, you see, from verse 18, because this is where the story becomes interesting from our point of view, because this is where Phinehas now is going to appear in the record. It says in verse 18, the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God and asked counsel of God and said, which of us shall go up first to the battle? By the way, when it says the house of God there, we do believe, and I think rightly so, that the house of God ought to be translated as a proper name, that is Bethel. In other words, it should be Bethel here, not the house of God. Only the Vulgate follows the line that it ought to be translated the house of God. The Septuagint version, the Syriac, the Chaldee, the Arabic, most of the modern manuscripts that flow from those principal sources all translate the word house of God in verse 18 as Bethel. The children of Israel arose and they went up to Bethel. And now I'm going to tell you why I think it was Bethel rather than the house of... Where was the house of God, by the way? The house of God was in Shiloh, wasn't it? The house of God was the tabernacle where the ark was. But you notice what it says in Judges 20 and verse 26. It says all the children of Israel went up to the house of God. Verse 27, they inquired of Yahweh, for the ark of the covenant of God was there in those days. Now, of course, you wouldn't need to say that the ark of God was there in those days if it was in the house of God, because the ark of God was always in the house of God. But you would want to say that the ark of the covenant was there if it was in a different place, wouldn't you? Somewhere out of the ordinary. There's no point saying, oh, by the way, the ark of God was in the tabernacle. Did you know that? Of course we knew that. But you see, what if it was somewhere else? And that's the point, you see, is that the house of God was at Shiloh, but the ark was at Bethel. And I know why the ark was there. I know why the ark was removed, and so do you, because if you come to Deuteronomy chapter 20, you'll remember that there was a principle enshrined in the law concerning the matter of battles. And I think this followed, by the way, hard on the heels of that occasion when Phinehas went out and led the army in Numbers 31 in the war against Midian. And shortly after that, in the next few months, when the book of Deuteronomy was written, we're told this in verse 1. It says, when thou goest out to battle against thine enemies, and seest horses and chariots and the people more than thou, be not afraid, for Yahweh thy God is with thee. Verse 2, and it shall be when ye come nigh unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people, and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, do not tremble, neither be terrified because of them. For Yahweh your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you. And so you see, the principle was enshrined in the law that when Israel went to battle, that the priest would be there to encourage them. And not only would he be there to encourage them, but he'd be there to seek counsel of God by Urim and by Thummim. He'd be there to seek the counsel of God in the matter of the safety and the ultimate victory of the warring army. And I think you see that what's happened here is that because the battle is going to be against Gibeah, that the Ark of God and Phinehas also have been removed to Bethel that they might be nearer the scene of battle so that the priest might go forth to encourage the people. And so here's Phinehas, you see, he's right in the story, right in the thick of the action, just as the battle is about to commence. He's there in Bethel where the Ark is on this occasion. By the way, just another point with regard to the translation of House of God as Bethel. You notice also in verse 31 of this same chapter it says, And the children of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city, and they began to smite of the people and kill as at other times in the highways, of which one goeth up toward the house of God and the other to Gibeah in the field. But we believe that the two highways of which the record speaks here is the road that forks between Bethel and Gibeah. The road doesn't go up to the house of God in Shiloh, it goes up to Bethel. That's where this highway ran. And so we believe that the phrase house of God in Judges 20 verse 18 and verse 26 and verse 31 should be in fact translated Bethel. And by the way, that's exactly what Josephus says in his book, in Antiquities book 5, chapter 2, verse 11. He says that the ark was indeed at Bethel at this particular time. And so now we've got the matter of the inquiries by Urim and Thummim that Phinehas is going to engage in on behalf of the nation here. We're now going to read the story, you see, of Phinehas involved in putting these questions, because you see in verse 18 when it says that they asked counsel of God and said, which of us shall go up first to battle? Now that would be Phinehas, wouldn't it, who would put the question. He's the speaking priest, isn't he? He's the one that will ask counsel of God. He will make inquiry on behalf of the nation. So the questions of these verses come from the mouth of Phinehas, do they not? So let's just read the story, shall we? You know, there's a lot to be found, isn't there, in the Bible, just by reading the story carefully. So let's read these verses. And the children of Israel arose, verse 18, and went up to Bethel and asked counsel of God and said, Which of us shall go up first to the battle against the children of Benjamin? And Yahweh said, Judah first. And the children of Israel rose up in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin. And the men of Israel put themselves in array to fight against them at Gibeah. And the children of Benjamin came forth out of Gibeah and destroyed down to the ground of the Israelites that day 22,000 men. And the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and set their battle again in array in the place where they put themselves in array the first day. And the children of Israel went up and wept before Yahweh until even and asked counsel of Yahweh, saying, Shall I go up again to battle against the children of Benjamin, my brother? And Yahweh said, Go up against him. And the children of Israel came near against the children of Benjamin the second day, and Benjamin went forth against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed down to the ground of the children of Israel again 18,000 men. All these drew the sword. Then all the children of Israel and all the people went up and came unto the house of God, Bethel, and wept and sat there before Yahweh, and fasted that day until even, and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Yahweh. And the children of Israel inquired of Yahweh, for the ark of the covenant of God was there in those days, and Phinehas the son of Eleazar the son of Aaron stood before it in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of Benjamin, my brother, or shall I cease? And Yahweh said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into thine hand. Now, you see how there is a definite development in the spirit of these three inquiries. Do you notice the change that's going on here? You see the first inquiry, verse 18. It says that they asked counsel of God, but what did they really say? They said, which of us shall go up first? You see, there was absolute confidence in the judgment they were about to execute. They didn't ask whether they should go up. They didn't ask whether it was the right thing to go up. They didn't ask whether they ought to bring judgment. They already knew that. They said, we just want to know who it is. Oh, very confident they were, weren't they? Which of us shall go up first? You see, their spirit was too hasty in assuming the divine approval of the judgment proposed. Their asking of this council, which, by the way, it would have come from the mouth of Phinehas, was perfunctory rather than earnest. It was far too swift, wasn't it? Now, you just watch and see if we can notice the development of the spirit of humility in the subsequent inquiries. Of course, you notice in verse 21 it says, the children of Benjamin came forth after that first council, wherein Phinehas was so assured that he had done the right thing. It says that they came forth and they destroyed down to the ground of the Israelites that day 22,000 men. How many were in the army of Benjamin, by the way? They destroyed 22,000 men that day. How many were in Benjamin's army? Verse 15. Why? 26,000. So that wasn't a bad haul for the first day, was it? 26,000 destroyed 22,000 on day one. And verse 22 says that the men of Israel encouraged themselves and said, actually, you know, on the next overhead, we've actually got the councils placed there side by side. Probably actually quite a good idea to look at this, because you can see the development of thought that occurs here. You see 4D, where it says that Phinehas asks counsel by Urim and Thummim. And here it is, verse 23. Now, what are the changes? Where is it different to the first one? Well, you'll notice firstly that it says this time that they went up and they wept before Yahweh until even, and they asked counsel of Yahweh. They didn't ask counsel of Yahweh the first time, they asked counsel of Elohim. Now it's counsel from Yahweh. And they wept before him until even, before the question was even put. And this time, you see, there's a much more careful spirit of inquiry, isn't there? You see verse 23, there's nothing self-assured this time. They ask counsel saying, I go up again to battle against the children of Benjamin, my brother. You see, there's some uncertainty of spirit now in Phinehas, isn't there, as to whether this was the right thing to do. From the initial supreme confidence that judgment ought to be executed without delay, there is now some uncertainty of spirit. Now look at verse 26 and to the last episode. After further defeat, verse 26, then, now where's the first change here? Then all the children of Israel and all the people went up. So there's the first change. They came to the house of God. They wept, they sat, they fasted, they offered. You see, this whole spirit of inquiry in verse 26 now is a much deeper thing altogether. The whole nation's in mourning now. They're in lamentation, aren't they? As Phinehas now comes forth to make counsel for the third time. I think Phinehas himself now was desperately uncertain as to what they ought to do. And so this time he says, does he not, in verse 28, shall I yet go out again to battle against the children of Benjamin, my brother, or shall I cease? And you see how the spirit of Phinehas has moved in the course of those three councils by Urim. It's gone from an assumption that the action was correct to a final pleading of desperate uncertainty. And I think there was a lesson for this, you see, not just in the nation, or not just for the nation, but for the men that pleaded their cause on this occasion. Now, lest you should think that, I have the wrong view on this, I just want to say this, I have no problem with the fact that judgment ought to have come upon Gibeah. That's absolutely clear, isn't it, in this record. Ought judgment to have been brought against Gibeah? And the answer is no doubt about that whatsoever. In fact, we know that for sure because God says so, doesn't he, at the end of verse 28, doesn't he? He says this. He says, at the end of, finally, the third inquiry, Yahweh said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into thine hand. You see, there's no difficulty with the fact that judgment ought to have occurred in this chapter against Gibeah. That was God's own mind in the matter. That's not the problem of this chapter. I'll show you where the problem is. Verse 43. Now, come and have a look at the end of the story, then, of the judgment against Gibeah. Thus they enclosed the Benjamites round about and chased them and trode them down with ease over against Gibeah toward the sun rising. And there fell of Benjamin 18,000 men. All these were men of valor, and they turned and fled toward the wilderness into the rock of Rimmon. And they gleaned of them in the highways 5,000 men and pursued hard after them unto Gedom and slew 2,000 men of them, so that all which fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men that drew the sword. All these were men of valor, but 600 men turned and fled to the wilderness unto the rock Rimmon and abode in the rock Rimmon 4 months. And now here's the real problem verse. This is where it all goes wrong, brothers and sisters. It's the 48th verse of Judges 20. And the men of Israel turned again upon the children of Benjamin and smote them with the edge of the sword, as well the men of every city as the beast, and all that came to hand, and they set fire to all the cities they came to. You see, what happened was that judgment against Gibeah was prosecuted under the divine approval. But at the end of that judgment, what the men of Israel then did is they turned round and they said, now let's wipe Benjamin out. Let's do the job properly. Men, women, children, animals, the lot. Gone. And isn't that where it went wrong in that verse? You see, they had never sought counsel of God for the extent of this judgment which they should execute. You see, the battle of this chapter had always been against Gibeah. You can read it in the record. They set themselves in array against Gibeah. God said, go up, for I shall deliver them into your hand. And now what's happened is that the fury of human vengeance has taken that judgment to such a degree that the whole tribe of Benjamin has now been decimated. That was not the divine mind. That had never been expressed. And worse was to come, because you see what chapter 21 and verse 1 says. It says that now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, there shall not any of us give his daughter unto Benjamin to wife. And the people came to Bethel and abode there till even before God, and lifted up their voices and wept sore and said, O Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, why is this come to pass in Israel, that there should be today one tribe lacking in Israel? And it came to pass on the morrow that the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And then they began to plot and to plan and to scheme as to what they might do to solve this problem of a tribe so decimated that there are now only 600 men left and no wives for any of them, because of the vow of Judges 21 verse 1. We shall not give our daughters unto Benjamin to wife. Interesting, actually. You see what it says in verse 2? It says, they wept sore. You see back in chapter 20 and verse 23 what it says? You see, in chapter 20 and verse 23, it says that the children of Israel went up and they wept before God
concerning the matter of destroying Benjamin. And now in chapter 21 and verse 2, the people come and they weep before God in the matter of rebuilding Benjamin. Because somewhere something's gone too far. And so they say in verse 3 of Judges 21, why is this come to pass that there should be today one tribe lacking in Israel? And again in verse 6, notice, the children of Israel repented them for Benjamin their brother and said, there is one tribe cut off from Israel this day. And again, verse 15, and the people repented them for Benjamin because that Yahweh had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Verse 15, Yahweh had made a breach. God had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. God hadn't made a breach, had he, brothers and sisters? Their own unrestrained rage had made the breach in Benjamin. It was never God's intention that Benjamin should be decimated or destroyed as a tribe, and there was one man who stood before them there that day who should have known that with absolute certainty, one man who knew that it was not in the purpose of God that Benjamin should be destroyed. Who might that have been? But Phinehas. And you know why he should have known that? Exodus chapter 28. Shouldn't he have known this thing? How foolish for a nation to lament before God that Yahweh had made a breach among the tribes of Israel, that there should be one tribe short that day, as if somehow it was God's fault. And Phinehas should have known that, that that was wrong. Exodus 28 and verse 15. And thou shalt make a breastplate of judgment with cunning work. Foursquare, verse 16, it shall be doubled. And verse 17, they shall set in its settings of stones, four rows of stones. Verse 21, and the stones shall be with the names of the children of Israel, 12, according to their names, like the engraving of a signet. Verse 30, and thou shalt put the breastplate of judgment, or thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and Thummim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart when he goeth in before Yahweh, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of Israel upon his heart before Yahweh continually. And when Phinehas the priest stood before God to inquire and to make counsel by Urim and Thummim, he wore upon himself the breastplate of judgment with the eternal stone in which was engraved the word Benjamin on his heart. So he should have known, should he not, that there was to be no breach amongst the tribes of Israel on that day. And yet look at the terrible things that unfold in the sequence then of Judges 20 as they endeavor to put right that which they have made wrong. There was really no need, you see, for the terrible plans which are now unfolded. And so verse 5 says of Judges 21, says, the children of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel that came not up with the congregation unto Yahweh? For they had made a great oath concerning him that came not up to Yahweh to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. And the children of Israel repented them for Benjamin their brother, and said, there is one tribe cut off from Israel this day. How shall we do for wives for them that remain, seeing that we've sworn by Yahweh that we will not give them of our daughters to wives? And they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that came not up to Mizpah to Yahweh? Behold, there came none to the camp from Jabesh Gilead to the assembly, for the people were numbered, and behold, there were none of the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead there. And the congregation sent to the 12,000 men of the valiantest and commanded them, saying, go and smite the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, with the women and children. And this is the thing that ye shall do. Ye shall utterly destroy every male and every woman that hath lain by man. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins that had not known man by lying with any male, and they brought them unto the camp to Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. So you see, someone came up with a splendid idea. Someone said, well, look, you see, we've given a vow, verse 1, which we swore in Mizpah, that we would not give our daughters to Benjamin to wife. So what we've got to do here is find someone that wasn't at Mizpah that was part of the oath concerning the daughters. Was there anyone that didn't come? And they numbered and they said, no one from Jabesh-Gilead came. So then they said, well, look, you see, what we can do here is we can uphold one vow in order to wriggle out of another. Because, you see, it also says in verse 5 that they'd sworn a further oath that he that came not up to Yahweh to Mizpah shall surely be put to death. They said, what a brilliant, brilliant solution, you see. You see, the Jewish mind is very fertile at devising solutions. And they said, you see, what we can do is we can uphold the vow that says they ought to be put to death because they didn't come to Mizpah. But how thankful they didn't come to Mizpah, because now we can take the virgin daughters of Jabesh-Gilead and give them to Benjamin, because they're not part of the vow that said that they wouldn't give their daughters. What a splendid solution. And so they did just that, you see. And verse 13 says, the whole congregation sent some to speak to the children of Benjamin that were in the rock Rimmon, and to call peaceably unto them. And Benjamin came again at that time, and they gave them wives which they'd saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet so they sufficed them not, and the people repented them for Benjamin. And then verse 16, they said, well, we've still got a problem, because how shall we do for wives for them that remain, seeing the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? And they said, well, there must be an inheritance for them that are escaped of Benjamin, that a tribe be not destroyed. But, we can't do anything ourselves, verse 18, because we've given an oath, and we've got to be true to our word. We've sworn, saying, cursed be he that giveth a wife to Benjamin. And then someone said, well, I've got another idea. And this person said, verse 19, they said, well, look, there's a feast to Yahweh in Shiloh yearly in a place which is on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that galleth up from Bethel to Shechem, and on the south of Labona. Therefore they commanded the children of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in wait in the vineyards, and see and behold if the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in dances. We're told, by the way, in Jeremiah 31 and verse 4, that on the occasion of the feast, the woman would go out and dance for the joy of the harvest. Now, who do you think the women were, the virgins of Shiloh were, that came out and danced the dances of joy here at the feast? I think they were probably similar to the woman of the 1st of Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22, when it speaks about the woman that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregations. I believe that they were virgins that had chosen to be servants at the sanctuary of God. Where would the virgins of Shiloh, by the way, come from? What tribe? Well, they would probably come in the main from the tribe in which Shiloh was to be found, and the tabernacle. And Shiloh, of course, was to be found in the land and in the tribe of Ephraim. So the virgin daughters of Shiloh who came to dance at the feast would probably be daughters of Ephraim. And verse 21 says, and see and behold, if the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance and dances, then come ye out of the vineyards, and catch you every man his wife of the daughters of Shiloh, and go to the land of Benjamin. And it shall be, when their fathers or their brethren come unto us to complain, that we will say unto them, be favourable unto them for our sakes, because we reserve not to each man his wife in the war, for ye did not give them at this time, that ye should be guilty. And the children of Benjamin did so, and took them wives, according to the number of them that danced whom they caught, and they went and returned unto their inheritance, and repaired the cities and dwelt in them. And you see in verse 22 where it says, be favourable for our sake, because we reserved not to each man his wife in the war, for ye did not give them at this time. I think what they were saying, you see, the leaders said to the men of Ephraim, to the tribe of Ephraim, well, look, we've got to solve a problem here, and don't worry, you've made a vow not to give your daughters, but don't worry, they haven't been given, they've been pinched. They've been taken by Benjamin. You didn't give them, so it's okay, you're free of the vow, just leave it be. And you see how it worked out, because you see, Benjamin was the son of who? Who was Benjamin the son of? Son of Rachel. So now we've got virgins that are taken from Jabesh Gilead and virgins that are taken from Shiloh to repair the cities in the tribe of Benjamin. Do you know where Jabesh Gilead lies? In what tribe? The half tribe of Manasseh. Do you know where the virgins of Shiloh come from? From the tribe of Ephraim. Do you know who Ephraim and Manasseh are? The offspring of Joseph. Do you know who Joseph is? The other son of Rachel. And they took the same bloodlines, you see. They took the offspring of Joseph via Ephraim and Manasseh, and they married them to the offspring of Benjamin, who were all sprung from one common mother, Rachel. And the Jews would have said, how neat and how tidy it is. And it was a dreadful, dreadful thing, wasn't it? May I remind you, brothers and sisters and young people, about how this whole matter started. This whole story began in Judges because one woman had been taken against her will. And by the time Israel had finished their plans to tidy up their mistakes, there have been 600 women taken against their will. Where's the justice in that? No, this was not a good thing, was it? This was not a good spirit, and this was not a good solution. This was the reasoning of the flesh, absolutely, through and through. And so we ask ourselves the question, you see, do you think Phineas had anything to do with that? And the answer is yes, I think he did. Now, in fact, we've got an overhead on that, so let's just have a look at that overhead, shall we? It's entitled, Phineas, Conspirator to Vengeance. And let's just read through those ideas, you see, because, you see, firstly, the threefold inquiry by Urim and Thummim through Phinehas gave divine counsel that inflicted judgment on Israel. Phinehas should have been warned by this, that all was not well with his spirit and with his attitude. In the terrible wrath of Israel that fell upon Benjamin, there was a judgment and a spirit of judgment that was too prompt, too implacable, too unsparing. You see, I believe that the story of Judges 20 is not the solemn exercise of divine judgment. It is the rash fury of human vengeance. This is vengeance gone mad, unrestrained, uncontrolled, unreasonable. And yet there's no mention, is there, anywhere in Judges that Phinehas, the high priest, the leader of the congregation, the spiritual head of the nation, no mention that he endeavoured to restrain that judgment, is there? And what about the subsequent remorse of Israel in Judges 21, where they come and they plot and they plan these other dreadful schemes? You see what it says in Judges 21 and verse 2? It says, the people came to the house of God and abode there till even, and lifted up their voices and wept sore. And they said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, why has this come to pass? They abode there before God, says the record. But how did they abide before God? And the answer is, they did it before the priest, didn't they? They came before the priest. So all of the plans of Judges 21 were hatched up in the presence of Phinehas. He knew about all of this. including the taking of all the virgins. And here's one final thing. Now, hold your hand in Judges 21 and come back to Numbers 31 so that you've got both references together. Numbers 31 on the one side and Judges 21 on the other side. Now, remember what it says in Judges 21, that when they decided to go against Jabesh-Gilead in verse 10, it says the congregation sent 12,000 men, and they said, now, this is what you've got to do, verse 11, utterly destroy every male, and utterly destroy every woman that hath lain by man, but you can take the young virgins, verse 12, for yourselves. Now, do you notice where all those ideas come from? You see, Numbers 31 says, doesn't it, in verse 4, of every tribe 1,000 throughout all the tribes of Israel, he shall send to the war. So there were delivered out of the thousands of Israel, 1,000 for every tribe, 12,000 men went to war. And what did they do, verse 7? Well, the first thing they did is that they slew all the males. And the next thing they did, verse 17, they killed every male among the little ones, and every woman that had known man by lying with him, but all the woman children that have not known man by lying with him, you can keep alive for yourselves. Do you see where all the thoughts come from in Judges 21? They're straight out of Numbers 31. Who led the battle in Numbers 31, which, by the way, was 40 years before? Who suggested that 12,000 men go and complete that battle? But the man who had led that battle 40 years before. Yes, you see, I think that Phinehas was terribly involved in this whole dreadful story, you see, of vengeance. You see, I think this is the old spirit of Levi, the cruelty of Levi, of which Jacob spake in Genesis 49. Cursed be their wrath, for it was cruel. Do you know why the wrath of Levi first came in Genesis 49? Do you know why Levi first showed his wrath? Remember what it was all about? It was because one of their women had been defiled. One of their women, that's right, had been defiled. You see, the vengeance of Judges 20 and 21, of which I believe that Phinehas must be counted as part, is the old vengeance of Levi, isn't it? Now, come and have a look at the at a reference in the 2nd of Kings. And in the 2nd of Kings, chapter 10. Now, in the 2nd of Kings, chapter 10, we have a man called Jehu. And I want you to notice what he does, verse 24. When they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings, Jehu appointed 80 men without and said, if any of the men whom I've brought into your hands escape, he that letteth them go, his life shall be for his life. Verse 25, he said, go in and slay them, let none come forth, and they smote them with the edge of the sword. You see, Jehu was known for his execution of judgment on the house of Ahab, wasn't he? Do you know how Jehu felt about all that? Verse 16, come and see my zeal for Yahweh. You see how Jehu defines zeal? It's the execution of divine judgment. Do you know who Jehu modeled himself on? Do you know who Jehu's hero was? And the answer is Elijah. He modeled himself on Elijah. Do you want to see that spirit in Elijah? Come and look at the same phraseology in the First of Kings and at the matter of Mount Carmel, First of Kings 18. See, this is exactly where Jehu gets his spirit from. In the First of Kings 18 and verse 40, Elijah said, "Take the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape." That's the very words that Jehu quotes. And they took them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. So you see, there's Elijah's act of judgment. Over the page, chapter 19, verse 9, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" Verse 10, and Elijah said, "I have been very zealous for Yahweh." Same word. Now, who did Elijah model himself on? He modeled himself on a man, brothers and sisters, of whom the record says this in a rather interesting chapter that we've already looked at, when it says, "Phinehas the son of Eleazar was zealous for my sake amongst them." Numbers 25 verse 11. You see, I think that Elijah modeled himself on the spirit of Phinehas. But you see, he counted the zeal of Phinehas by counting the extent of judgment that Phinehas brought forth. And part of the story of the judgment of Phinehas was the danger of vengeance run to extreme in Judges 20 and 21. And Elijah took that up and said, "That's the zeal of Phinehas, and I shall emulate that." And he was wrong. That wasn't the true spirit of Phinehas, was it? And it wasn't the zeal that any of us would want to emulate. You see, they both modeled themselves on Phinehas. They were both enthused by his zeal, but they had a bias towards destruction rather than towards nourishing. They saw zeal as attacking apostasy rather than as building truth. And I think that's where Elijah got his spirit from. He saw himself as... In fact, do you know that the Jews claim that when Phinehas was promised the covenant of an everlasting priesthood in Numbers 25, they claimed that he was given immortality then and there, and that Phinehas disappeared, but that he reappeared in the divine record as Elijah. That's what the Jews actually teach. They believe that Phinehas and Elijah were the same person. Of course, we know that that's absolutely wrong, but what we do believe is that the same spirit was to be seen between the two men, and that Elijah modeled himself on the earlier man, but this was not the spirit of zeal that ought to have been copied. And as we're going to see in our study tomorrow morning by way of exhortation, God willing, we're going to find that there was a much better spirit in Phinehas. This was a bad moment in his life. And we know why it happened, because you see, as we've said before, he was a man who absolutely hated corruption. He knew what that could do in the nation. He was scared stiff of the influence of corruption, but you see, his very zeal at times carried him to excess. And I think he's an old man now, by the way. I believe if you look at your timeline, I think you'll find that I've suggested that this occurs when he's about 90 years of age. He's an old man. He knows no other way. He spent all his life fighting corruption. He knows no other way than what he's engaged in here in Judges 20 and 21. But it is not a good time in his life and not a good spirit to follow. Let's look at our concluding summary sheet, shall we? Zeal and the danger of vengeance. How easy it is for zeal to run to excess where divine judgment instead becomes human vengeance. Phinehas, no doubt, despaired of corruption within Israel. But in his reforming zeal, his fierce spirit contributed to a dreadful litany of sins: extreme vows, rash fury, terrible brutality, fleshly reprisal, deceitful contrivance, cunning casuistry, sheer hypocrisy, all followed in rapid succession from the first era of excessive vengeance. Phineas had to learn that the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God, and that without a wiser balance, this spirit would only divide, destroy, and decimate. Zeal for the truth is not measured by the number slain, but by the number saved. We ought never to forget that, brothers and sisters, in our zeal to uphold divine principles, that the divine mind itself is that men and women ought to be saved so that they may reflect him in the age to come. We shall turn with a thankful mind, brothers and sisters, to more positive things on the morrow, having reached, we believe, this evening the darkest moment in his life. But did not Abraham make a bad mistake? Did not David make a bad mistake? Is not this Phineas's bad moment, as we all have in our lives? How thankful that we can look to the spirit of a greater and a better high priest, of whom we read these words: the names of all the saints he bears engraven on his heart. Nor shall the meanest saint complain that he hath lost his part. Those characters shall firm remain our everlasting trust when gems and monuments and crowns have moulded into dust.